Welcome to this week's edition of Radioactive Magazine on KKFI with Dave Mitchell. We have with us today Ms. Connie Campbell, who has a PhD in literacy and psychology. At the April 29 climate rally in the Unity Temple vestibule, there was a synchronistic coming together of Bill Claus, producer of Radioactive Magazine, who is with us here today, Connie Campbell, and myself. Bill had a digital recorder with him and asked what brought Connie to the climate rally. That led to an interaction with Connie for 2.5 hours yesterday, involving a rather extended conversation. And here we are today talking with Connie on the radio. Connie is the co-founder and president of Human Interactions Incorporated and has managed human development systems, educational policy development, and applied research for more than 25 years. She is a learning specialist and psychometrist with a broad background in assessment, and she has designed and implemented large-scale normed psychometric evaluations and educational projects for federal agencies, school districts, national nonprofit social service agencies, and individual clients. Connie is also a forensics expert and a textbook author in the field of literacy and diagnosis. And she has been recognized for her leadership in advancing experiential learning programs in economics and science for young people. Connie, welcome to the Radioactive Magazine.
Well, it's a delight to be here. Okay. Thank you, Dave.
Well, glad to have you. Glad to have you. To begin, one of your competencies is as a psychometrist. Can you describe what a psychometrist does?
It's the aspect of psychology that does measurement. So a psychometrist is the one who designs, administers, or interprets diagnostic measures. So you have to have a certain level of certification and education to administer, interpret an IQ test, for example. But it's also the whole field of profiling. So on a large scale basis, this would be the person who, depending on what their specialty is, and mine is education, so reading assessments for school systems and understanding what are the reading trends and issues in that, as well as the atypical learners who need to have special diagnosis, such as you have a suspicion that your child has dyslexia. How would you have that diagnosed? So a psychometrist is the one that does that. So it's often accompanying another field, that's why a lot of people are often somewhat puzzled when I say I'm a psychometrist. They're not used to that term.
Right. Right. In the extended conversation that we had, there was we're going to get to the issue of climate change in a moment, but we had a conversation around you used the imagery of a U with
the letter U,
the
right.
letter U with the two endpoints sort of representing extremes variety of view.
Exactly.
Among the population.
You can apply it to many, many topics or issues where you have on one side of the U, you have an extreme rigid position. And then as you flow down the U, most people are somewhere in the continuum at the bottom of the U. And then you go up the right side, you have the opposite extreme position. And what they have in common, they have much more in common with each other than they often do with people down at the bottom of the U, because the ideology is very rigid, it's perfectionistic, and it's very judgmental, and it is very black and white. My way is the right way, and your way is not different. Your way is wrong and evil. And so you have a very high level of rigidity and thinking that is not flexible. And actually, it's related to a lot of issues around human development and their childhood and there's lots of variables that affect it. But it's very crucial for us to understand that when we see extreme positions, that they're the flip side of the same coin.
Right, and this can in any controversial issue, you're going to get extremes on the ideological left and the ideological right, or or you're going to get extreme positions within a society. You're going to get these extreme positions. Certain people are going to gravitate either to an ideological position on the left or an ideological position on the right.
Correct.
And it could be over a whole range of issues.
Matter of fact, you could almost take any issue. Uh-huh. People can get very animated about how you cook a chicken, or should you even cook a chicken? Mm-hmm. You know, it can range from very minute details. Those of us who remember Ann Landers, her greatest controversy that she ever had with the greatest readership was, which way does the toilet paper flow, over or under, when you put it into the socket?
I don't remember that.
You don't remember that, but it is one.
I'm sure.
Okay,
I'm sure it happened.
But it shows where it actually moves into an unthinking. Many times, what happens is you adopt an unthinking value system, and this alleviates you from thinking. I mean, if you have a closed mind, there's a lot of relief from that, because you don't have to have the anxiety of new innovations, new challenging data, anomalies in your position that don't work. You know, it just, this is right, it's absolute, and it's somewhat almost religious in its nature. You know, it's that I believe it, and it's a belief system rather than a thinking, analytical process that you've come to that solution.
Okay. So there's really the seeking of certainty.
It is perfectionism. So it's actually a term that I found after, you know, we started talking about this, a term that I think really captured is principled perfectionism. So these principled perfectionists or puritanical compulsives, that's another term that is sometimes used in the, you know, in analyzing the personality profile of someone who holds very rigid, often hostile and aggressive attitudes towards anyone who disagrees with him or her. And there's a world-oriented perfectionism, the belief that precise, correct, and perfect solutions exist, and I have that solution. So you can actually see how you can hold this. When I was growing up, there was very, very strong opinions about communism, and it was not just that it was a not functional, not long term. It wasn't as effective as a more open economic system. It was that it was evil, that Satan was behind it. You know, that it was. Contaminated. And whenever you get into a situation where something is contaminated and that we can't interact because I might be polluted by it, that's part of this too. If I hear your, if I dialogue with you, you might pollute my thinking rather than we would together come to new solutions.
Okay. I'm talking with Dr. Connie Campbell about psychological aspects of extreme positions and how this applies to the climate change debate. Okay, and I'm going to dive now into global warming and climate change.
Right.
And obviously, it is quite polarized. It has become quite polarized, and tragically along partisan lines. The 2016 Republican Party platform affirms their roots in conservation and views preservation of the environment as linked with economic growth and technological advancement. They further state, and I quote, "The environment is too important to be left to radical environmentalists. They are using yesterday's tools to control a future they do not comprehend. They are a self-serving elite stuck in the mindset of the 1970s. Global warming is based on shoddy science." That's a paraphrase. "Climate change is based on shoddy science, scare tactics, and centralized command and control regulation." And then they put out a few specifics, more than a few, but I just wrote down a few. "We will forbid the EPA to regulate carbon dioxide. We reject the agendas of the Kyoto Protocol and the Paris Climate Agreement, which cannot be binding until ratified by the U.S. Senate." On the other hand, the 2016 Democratic Party platform embraces essentially a polar opposite viewpoint. Their platform states, and I quote, "Climate change is an urgent threat and a defining challenge of our time. The best science tells us that without ambitious immediate action across our economy to cut carbon pollution and other greenhouse gases, all these impacts will be far worse in the future. We cannot leave our children a planet that has been profoundly damaged." The Democrats support the concept of a clean energy economy by mid-century, as well as meeting President Obama's pledge to reduce U.S. carbon emissions as part of the Paris Climate Agreement. Having heard these quotes, which are almost polar opposites, what is your assessment of these group dynamics?
Well, first of all, I'm going to challenge that they're polar opposites.
Well, I think they share the view that the environment is important.
They're polar opposites in terms of the actions to be taken.
Yes.
I'm just going to capture something that was interesting to me as a psychometrist is the Republican position. I don't see or hear a solutions-based direction to it. I see it as a defensive solution against current actions. I'm also always interested when I'm in a conversation with someone and they're using terms like radical, self-serving, shoddy, you don't know what you do not know what you do, which implies you're not knowledgeable, so kind of implying you're not intelligent. There's a lot of fear. There's a lot of fear on that side of it that I think corresponds very much to a concern that people would have that there are going to be solutions that are defined on the other side that may not be in their best interest.
You know, the thing about it, they do refer to radical environmentalists who are relying on shoddy science and that they're self-serving elite. So where do you think their fear is coming from?
I think it's not only fear, but a crucial issue for us to have a chance for a cohesive understanding by the public and for the public to support good public policy is that we also have to eliminate reality distortions. So a critical issue is, and this is where the U does work, is you can have a situation where there is no climate change at all, there's absolutely none, when the evidence has been quite compelling over a long period of time, at least 15 to 20 years. The other opportunity here is that, so you have a denial of reality, distortion of reality. The U is when you also have the distortion of reality that if we don't change today, if we don't all go to electric cars, if we don't eliminate all oil-based products, if we don't do this eliminate the current way that we have the economy designed, that also does not seem real to people at the bottom of the U. So a critical issue for the people at the bottom of the U is what is reality? And fear distorts reality on both sides. It also is a sign of when you hold these very rigid positions, it often means there is a high level of shame or guilt that you feel. And no one wants to feel shame creates a sense of being shorn from the herd, and it's a very debilitating emotion. And almost anything feels better than shame. So instead of experiencing something as a shaming or guilt, like, you know, a large part of my income might come from oil stocks, I don't want to really go there, you know, because it's not my best interest to really understand that too much because it will really affect my life. Mm-hmm. However, that doesn't mean that shame and guilt doesn't worm its way into the feelings or the emotion. Or if you have personally been attacked or in your family there has been discussion and you feel that you have been made to feel shamed or guilty for your lifestyle, what happens is then rigidity often sets in as a defense mechanism.
Mm-hmm. You know, there is, I think there is I suspect that on a collective basis among the American population in general, that there is that sense of, there is sort of that, I suspect that there is sort of a collective sense of shame around the fact that we do have such a wealthy society that produces such a large amount of fossil fuels. And historically, we produce the most in the world. And right now, I believe we're number two, producing about 18% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So there is that. But, you know, the 2016 Republican Party platform, curiously, does not mention climate change directly, you know. And the 2008 Republican Party platform did mention climate change. And they did talk about the need to take some steps. But in 8 years, they went to a much more rigid and inflexible and condescending attitude towards the other side.
Condescension is also an aspect of a of a rigid point of view, because what it does is when you use terms like self-serving elites or whatever, where you're trying to lower the what it does is that I'm on a high plane and you're on a low plane, and which is also a way of to shame you. You know, I am the smart person, you are the naive, stupid person, and I have to make the decisions because I can't trust you to make decisions because you are inadequate. And it even has a sense of sending a message, not only are you inadequate, but you're defective. You're defective in some way. Well, when that is either projected on you or you project it on others, you can't work as equals. And I'm not speaking of equals in terms of we're not all peers. For example, if there was a scientist here who had done years and years of work of this on this, I'm going to defer to that person. I'm going to be listening to that person because he or she will know more than I do. But in terms of our democracy, I'm equal to that person in having a right to dialogue with a sense of trust that we're going into this with goodwill, with good intentions.
You know, that is a very good point. I know we kind of talked about that in our extended conversation. It's kind of mystifying to me in a way that there is a significant part of the American population that refuses to believe that 97% of climate scientists concur that fossil fuel emissions are warming the planet, that human use of fossil fuel emissions are warming the planet. And so there is this extreme discounting process going on, and it's not rational. It's not rational in any kind of way. And it's reflected in the statement I read from the Republican Party platform that radical environmentalists are relying on shoddy science, and that they're a self-serving elite. So there's all sorts of judgment and discounting in those statements. What thoughts do you have about why there's a significant portion of the population that's going that way? I mean, things are getting more divided. It seems that things are getting more divided, not less. So
I think a critical issue that we've got to be looking at is how do people learn? How do we change when we need to change our point of view? Our knowledge becomes obsolete. And I believe that we're in an era where, we're getting more and more top-heavy with older people, speaking as one, that the rate of change is so great right now that we're really almost have, we have hurry sickness. I just bought a new phone, and I had a previous phone for maybe 3 years, and the new phone is so complicated, I just have been very frustrated with it. Well, every day, if you are someone who had grew up with a sense of optimism, and I could be anything that I wanted, and I can achieve more than my parents, and there's unlimited opportunity for me, and you're running into the realities of the 21st century, there's a lot of demoralized feelings. It's a despondency that can happen to you. And so one of the ways that you can deal with that is to reject. That's the power I have. It's somewhat like a child who says no. You know, no, I'm not going to listen. I'm not going to do what you say. I'm not going to go to bed. I don't want to. No, I'm not tired. And at the same time, we need love and valuation of each other more and more and more under these circumstances. So a critical thing that we've got to do is to engage people with their tacit knowledge. What we often do on the left is lecture at them. Here's this famous researcher. He has spent all this time, and he's really smart. He's very, very smart. He's a genius. And he says there's climate change. Well, I'm sitting here, and well, you don't need to hear from me then, do you? You know, I mean, what role do I have in this? And how do I go from his really smart and his complex graphs and things like that to something that impacts my life? I've got to attach it to a value. That's where the emotion comes from. We act based on our values, and you know it's a value when you feel the emotion in it. So how are we going to create the stories and the interactions between and among ourselves so that the value that people have and their experiences, where they can start to imagine, we talked earlier about bottled water. You know, every time you take out, you know, you buy in bulk the bottled water, it's so convenient, and it goes in the refrigerator, and it's cold, and you can just run off with it. It's very convenient, but it's very damaging to the environment for us to multiply that by 100 million people in the U.S. using bottled water. Right. So how do we connect these very broad, ambitious, important, and I think legitimate goals around the economy, around the climate, and bring it back into a sense of reality for everyday people that doesn't guilt them, doesn't shame them, doesn't denigrate them, and is giving them hope also for the future.
Right. Well, I know we talked about, I kind of made the point that I think when the environmental community says to the world or to other people, you know, the science says, you know.
Yes, yes,
97%
right.
of climate scientists say, and then the conclusions, then you're saying that there's sometimes people have difficulty connecting.
They have difficulty connecting and their real life experience has been, you've been wrong before. Remember when it was, we weren't supposed to eat any fat, you know? Mm-hmm. Remember when we weren't supposed to do this, we weren't supposed to do that, and then new science came out and said that it is, no, we were wrong. So you have experiences, practical experiences that people have had, and you've got to then be able to show very patiently and systematically how this is undeniable.
And you have to bring up specific examples. I know one of the arguments on the other side of, from the Republican point of view is that, well, scientists were talking about global cooling back in the 70s.
Exactly. We need to have population control, and now look at China. They're actually going to have a major economic problem because they don't have enough young people, and we don't have enough young people. And
okay. But yeah, I know we talked about, in terms of environmental messaging, the realities are, you know, 15 years ago it was not so blatantly obvious that the climate is changing and is changing, and now it's blatantly obvious. And not only that, but there are major effects going on, and one that I brought up was the Great Barrier Reef off Australia is in the process of, it's in a death spiral essentially. There has been two major bleaching events in the last 12 months, the first one being the upper third, and the second one most recently being the middle third. And so there is, so in terms of messaging, there needs to be discussion of that along with pictures. There has to be, but I think you try to, not only the Great Barrier Reef, but you try to create links. You try to create links that people can connect to. And I know you brought up the example of songbirds.
Of songbirds. One of the crucial issues, living in the middle of Kansas City, there's some experiences that we don't have that others are having. And you and I had talked about, I visit Florida fairly frequently, and the rising ocean is also flooding Miami. And I was in Miami at a time when the high tide was at a very high tide, and I actually experienced how Miami Beach was flooding. Now, that doesn't affect me in Kansas City, but the whole issue around Sombergs, we are known as a wonderful center for the migration. We're in the pathway of songbirds, and many people in Kansas City love Kansas City for this diversity of birds. And yet, they can't live if they are triggered instinctually by warmer temperatures to lay eggs that they then can't, when they mature, they can't feed them because the worms are not, that they are using, are at the same stage of development for that.
Yeah, the worms haven't come out yet for
that's
them
right.
to feed their babies, so the babies starve. And,
right.
And, well, I know the Climate Solutions Caucus and the Republican House, or the House, excuse me, House of Representatives, is a bipartisan caucus, and the two congressmen, a Republican and Democrat, who got it started, are both in Florida.
Oh, I can see why. Yes,
Marco Rubio
is very real.
I'm not so sure if Marco Rubio is from the Miami area or not, but sea level rise is a big issue down there, and there are significant parts of southern Florida that are quite low. So it's affecting them directly, and there's 18 Republicans who are on that caucus and 18 Democrats. So, but. Connie, I'm afraid that we are out of time.
It was so much fun.
It was. I'm sorry that we can't talk longer, but thank you so much for being on the show, and we very much appreciate it.
Well, thank you.
Okay, thank you.